Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
And we're here with Tamson and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday, Easter Sunday.
That's right.
April 16th, 2017. And we have a special guest.
For a special reason. We have no other than Sadie Abuhoff.
Sadie Eleanor Abuhoff.
And she was brought in for a special mission. Only one girl could fulfill this mission for us. We are here to talk about Beauty and the Beast, the new movie which is taking the nation, if not the world. And for us to evaluate this, we had to bring in someone who saw the earlier version of Beauty and the Beast in 1991.
You know, we had to search high and low for somebody who had seen the 1991
version. We had to go down to Arlington, Virginia, finding a girl who was revealed to be 6 years old at the time of the 1991 version, and drag her up here across state lines to see this new version and speak to us as to what she thought of the new version of Beauty and the Beast. And here she is, for limited time only, Sadie Eleanor Abuhoff. Sadie, nice What's to have you here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Okay. And now let's get right to it here. What did you think of the new version of Beauty and the Beast?
Overall, I thought it was very successful in what it was trying to do. I think, you know, the real people versions are rough for some of the Disney musicals, but this one's definitely a viable, like, real person movie. Because they do a really good job with any of the all the characters that are, you know, the animated CGI inanimate objects. I thought they did a good job with that. And that was really, you know, I thought that was the biggest obstacle for them. So aside from that, I thought it was across the board pretty solid. I mean, it's not ever going to be as magical as the 1991 version because I'm not 6 years old. And
but shouldn't it be magical? I'm not sure I thought it was as magical as it really should be. And is that just because we have those other images and songs completely stuck in our heads? Or, you know, is it at all possible for a redo of something that you are that attached to?
I mean, I thought it was magical in a different way.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's not as magical as, you know, the first time you see the cartoon. But I thought the palace was done really well. I thought...
Oh, the palace.
Her dresses were really nice. Like, you're not going to get that wow factor with a cartoon. You're going to get that more with the, like, real people palace with a little bit of CGI. So
But none of the songs really knocked me for
me. See, I think Sadie makes a very good point. So more than either of us, Tamsin, Sadie is looking at this from a moving vantage point. Whereas you and I were in 1991, we were somewhat mature. Perhaps we're a little more mature now. But Sadie was six. And Sadie's now that many years older than six. So it's kind of, has to be hard to compare.
But Sadie's watched it many more times than we have.
Really? You've watched it since then?
Beauty and the Beast?
I've seen it from time to time, but I will remind you that we had a discussion about Disney musicals probably like 10 years ago or so. And Dad, I believe you said that you thought Beauty and the Beast was critically the best out of the group.
Well, I might have.
Top two with Little Mermaid.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very tough to beat Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid was the first, so it has a special place.
And Beauty only has a few songs. But, I mean, I still hear them today, and they resonate.
Well, they're fantastic songs. Yeah. And they're fantastic songs, frankly, whether you're talking about the cartoon or you're talking about live action. Although I will say that I agree with you, Tamsin. The songs came off better a little bit in the cartoon. Here's the way it came to me, and I broke it down this way, and I'm probably bringing it down too much. So I think that I will say that the critical analysis of the movie that matters is Sadie's, because Sadie was the girl in 1991. And I get that. And we're in a different part outside the periphery of the target audience. But it seems to me there's two pieces to this. There's the comparison of live action versus cartoon. And the live action brings something the cartoon doesn't have, as Sadie said, particularly with the main characters. But there's also the comparison of what I'll call the digital processing versus the cartoon. In other words, most of the movie, even now, is still animated because most of the characters are still animated.
Right.
So now you're comparing these characters like Cogsworth, the clock, Lumiere, the candelabra, who are now CGI, if that's the right phrase, and comparing them to the cartoons. And how did that come out? And the truth is, the cartoon was much superior in my mind.
You think that's the technology or the people who played those characters?
I think it's the technology, honestly. It might be both, but I mean, the nice thing, the CGI you look at, there's the oh wow factor. Wow, they're really making the candelabra move. And for me, that's interesting for half a second. For other people, maybe longer than half a second. But in terms of the ability to be expressive with respect to the characters, the cartoons lend themselves to more personality on the part of the voices, and that's why the songs are better. So in a certain way, half the movie is enhanced by the live action, but half the movie is a step back because of the CGI versus the cartoon. I mean, what do you think of that, Sadie? Does that make any sense to you?
It makes a little bit of sense, but I think also you have seen the cartoon, so you know at this point you have an expectation of what you want those characters That's to true. Be. I think that affects it. Because if you just saw those characters as they were in CGI and doing the same jokes that they did in the first version, you'd probably think they were really funny. But you know that in the first version, it was really funny then because it was the first time you heard that joke.
Yeah. Now, well, you know, you've got me there. I mean, you really have me there. So, I was mentioning before that one of the things that made the movie work, not just for me, but I thought for a lot of people, a lot of fathers, right, who were my age when I first saw it, was the funny thing being that Lumiere, who has...
you like the Lumiere character.
Yeah, in the cartoon in 1991 was Jerry Orbach. And Jerry Orbach...
Of Dirty Dancing fame.
Of Dirty Dancing fame.
Law and Order fame.
Of Law and Order, so that I think most of our listeners and viewers would know him as Law and Order fame, but also in many musicals, 42nd Street.
A Song and Dance Man.
A Song and Dance Man, the original Chicago, the original Fantastics.
So it makes sense that he could play a Song and Dance
Well, here's the great thing about that. He's playing the candelabra. He's got this funny French accent. And I heard some interview with him. And they said, how'd you come up with that crazy French accent? He's from the Bronx. He's not kidding. He is Lenny. That's who he is, the guy in Law and Order. He said, it's a combination in my mind of Maurice Chevalier and Pepe Le Pew. Pepe Le Pew was an old cartoon character. And I will tell you this, that resonated with a lot of dads. And I can tell you, I was sitting at a cafeteria in a large law firm just a few weeks ago when this came out. We got into a brief discussion of Beauty and the Beast and the original cartoon, and one of those dads, not me, just looked up from his tuna salad and said, Jerry Orbach. I am telling you that Jerry Orbach was a key part of that, and I will also submit, and I'll leave it to Sadie, and we'll depart from this, is that to me, that song, Be Our Guest. Is to me the leading song in the entire division of Disney. That sort of symbolizes everything Disney is about, and it has one of the great lyrics. Which
is your favorite.
My favorite lyric is, try the gray stuff, it's delicious. Don't believe me, ask the dishes. Cole Porter never wrote a lyric like that.
Well, I don't know. Sadie, what do you say to that?
I don't know if it's... I mean, I understand that it aligns with Disney's brand. I don't think it's the leading... It's not the best song in that movie.
Okay.
I think the best song in that movie is Bonjour, but... That's just my taste.
All the songs are good because they do exactly what a song in a musical needs to do. They really tell you what's going on. They describe the character and they move the action along. And they set the scene. They do a lot of work.
You know, Sadie's right. The Bonjour song is a classic, what Stephen Sondheim would say, a classic introduction character song, and it is right up there with all the classic musicals, and it was meant to be that way. It's not cartoonish.
It reminds me a little bit, this might be a stretch, it reminds me a little bit of the Telephone Song in Bye Bye Birdie, where you got all the characters like
call and response kind of thing.
Talking to each other. You kind of do the full survey.
What's the story, Morning Glory?
You do the full survey of the town.
Well, I know, knowing you as I do, Sadie, that is high praise indeed.
I mean, most of my references go back to Bye Bye Birdie, but... back to the Lumiere, I know that Ewan McGregor was in this version, and I saw an interview with him saying that he had not seen the cartoon version, and the reason he has a solid French accent is because his wife is French. So I don't know how much, you know, Pepe Le Pew research he did for this piece.
But, you know, it's possible that the less realistic...
Yeah.
Humor is a little bit...
Yeah, look, Ewan McGregor
was fine. Well,
I'm
just saying that he came from a totally different space.
Yes,
I mean, I don't think he was probably not as aware of the iconic...
You know something? I don't disagree with any of this. All I'm really saying was the original 1991 version was a huge success. It's a huge success for Disney. It was a huge success in spurring this new version. And a lot of it had to do with the fun that those... participants, those actors and those animators had with the subject in 1991. There was a tremendous sense of fun, and Jerry Orbach was a big part of that.
But what I'm curious about is, this seems to be a trend with Disney, but how far can they take it? Because they did it with Cinderella, but you can't really do this with Little Mermaid, it would be just 100%.
Dumbo.
Well, Little Mermaid would be 100% CGI because it has to be all underwater or half underwater. And all the Ursula stuff. Well,
you can do
that
at the Wiki Waki Springs.
That's right, where they teach the mermaids how to breathe underwater.
Right,
yeah.
You may have missed
but
that.
But then, class. I mean, Lion King is completely CGI.
Right. But look, I only mentioned Dumbo because Michael Keaton has already been signed on to that project. So they're not kidding.
Right. But are they doing that CGI? Are they doing it with like elephants?
I think the Michael Keaton part will not be CGI.
You think?
All right. All right. So thanks, Sadie. We appreciate you coming all the way up from Virginia for this.
Yes.
And
it's
we'll
the
have
only
you
reason.
Up for, have you up for Dumbo.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks. Have a good trip home.
This is point.
Okay, Sadie had to run on her way back to Arlington. I just had one or two little things to say the real attention to detail that was going on in that movie kind of struck me. I mean, if you're an art history teacher, you see things like her ballroom, that one room was in her castle, prison of the Beast, was almost a exact recreation of the, Room of Mirrors in the Hall of Mirrors in the Nymphenburg Palace from the early 18th century. It's in Munich, but it's designed by a French guy.
That's the palace I had in mind, the Nymphenburg.
Well,
You showed me the picture. You're right.
Right. It's and of course, the town, in the beginning, looks a lot like towns we were in Brittany, Normandy, Mont Saint Michel.
These winding hilly streets
Very, very, very true life. And the big numbers really make you think of shout out to Busby Berkeley and is that his name?
Yeah,
Busby
absolutely.
Berkeley and Esther Williams kind of things.
Well, Busby Berkeley did the Esther Williams things,
Those big over the top.
Yeah, Busby Berkeley being the choreographer and director, and Esther Williams being the great swimmer who was participating in these in the pool numbers.
Yeah.
The waterworks. But yeah.
So there was a tremendous amount going on there.
Yeah.
Maybe too much. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it is kind of funny that it took us all this time to even see this movie that I think the whole Western world has seen already a month ago.
Yeah, that's okay.
But we've got more movies on our list.
I'm just going to... Yeah. Well, it could have taken more time. It's not a must-see by any means, but it's interesting. It's fun to see it with your daughter, who saw the 1991 version. But Tamsin's right. There are a couple of things we ought to mention here. You can't keep up at this point of the year. You know, the first few months of this year, people don't put things out. They kind of take a deep breath. And you don't see much. The movies are kind of mediocre. But now you're seeing stuff, even plays. So there's a very interesting play that came on. We haven't seen it yet. We'll let you know when we do. It's called Oslo. And got a fantastic rave from the New York Times. They describe it as an against-the-odds story of international peacemaking. Undeniably a big play, as expansive and ambitious as any in recent Broadway history. That's sort of a rave. And the story, the unlikely story, is a story of a Norwegian husband and wife who in the early 1990s initiated the series of secret peace talks between Israel and the PLO that led to the Oslo Accords. Doesn't sound like Busby Berkeley. Doesn't sound too much like Broadway.
Right, so the question is it the overtop review to, try to make up for... To try to encourage people to come see it.
It is a look.
Is it legitimately one of those plays that, it's unlikely
you don't
plot
know.
Subject and yet completely compelling
You don't know.
Theater.
Tam is right. I mean, so there are plays that the Times wants to like. And there are plays that the Times tries to give a little boost to, tries to spur the audience. You got to be careful with that. But we'll see. They do make an observation here which rings true for me. And I guess it's part of the quote of the play. And it's only through the sharing of the personal that we can see each other for who we truly are. It's all the political is personal at the end, which, I can see that being a theme in the play. I can see that being persuasive. I happen to think it's true. And it could be interesting. The same theme is in a movie that opened just this week to some degree. Talk about an unlikely movie. The movie called Norman, starring Richard Gere as a Jewish fixer. A fixer being a guy who fixes problems, puts people together, tries to work behind the scenes to make things happen just for the pleasure of making things happen, not necessarily for profit. And as they point out here, Norman is that's the character. Norman is a con artist, a spinner of exaggerations, half-truths, and outright lies. He's running kind of a social pyramid scheme, promising extravagant returns on small investments of kindness and courtesy, and he almost succeeds. With thrilling subtlety and impressive clarity, a fable blossoms from the satirical earth. Well, that's a lot to fathom. I don't know exactly what's going on there. It is a very strong review. He stars with a fellow named Lior Ashkenazi, an actor who's supposed to be extremely well-known in Israel. And I've heard sort of a funny interview where he walks the streets with Richard Gere and has generally benefited by not being recognized in the U.S. I mean, people mobbed Richard Gere. Unfortunately, they ran into a bunch of Israeli fans in New York, and the reverse happened. So he was a little embarrassed by that.
Yeah.
And the other movie I'll just mention in passing is one I just hear good things about, which is called Their Finest, which is one of what I'll call the English Home Fliers movie. And I mentioned Home Fliers because we're watching Masterpiece Theater, which is Sundays at 9. That's their Home Flier series. Masterpiece Theater, PBS, does make a fair living on series that take place on the home front during World War II. And Their Finest is that kind of movie also, but it's supposed to be extremely good.
Yeah, and I've got more on my list. I've got The Graduation, maybe Quiet Passion, the one about Emily Dickinson.
Right.
It gets a good review. So an impossible list. We've got to get to it, though.
Yes, we have to. Right. We got the big one out of the way, Beauty and the Beast, and now we can go on. I think you want to talk about Metropolitan Diary.
Well, just a little snippet. You know, there's this column, or would you call it a column?
Sure.
In the New York Times called Metropolitan Diary, and it's made up of little vignettes sent in by readers about little episodes or little things they notice around New York. Mm-hmm. And this week it was, I thought, very good. And one of the little stories, and they're all titled, they all start out, Dear Diary, told about a woman, the story of a woman going to work every day and passing a particular guy for years, mm-hmm. and just exchanging pleasantries, and then eventually even introducing themselves to each other, mm-hmm. and just remarking on things they had noticed over the years.
Oh yeah, I wrote this.
You know, and that kind of resonated with me because there are, I have the same thing, and
right.
maybe you do too. Right. Going to work or whatever, people that are part of your sort of personality
right.
landscape.
Right.
And they're part of your life. You don't really know them.
They didn't even talk to each other for a while. So one finally opens up to the other and said, I know when your son, when he was SKs, and the other responds, it says, and I knew you when your hair wasn't gray.
Right, yeah. And then at a certain point, the guy gets a job and moves away. And
yeah,
there's this gap
right.
this in her life. But, and there are a couple other just nice little vignettes about
yeah.
urban life.
Yeah, sometimes those
are good to watch out
and they're
for.
Sent in by readers.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, those are good. The Times had an article, it's kind of unusual. It's called really about what's the best single sports season in the history of sports, any sport. And what prompted was the Times is asking the question, did Russell Westbrook have the best sports season ever?
So who's Russell Westbrook?
That's a fair question. He's a basketball player for the Oklahoma City team who had a year in which he broke the record for triple-doubles.
Triple-doubles?
Yeah, I have to explain this, and that's
part
of the problem.
Okay, that's like field goals, foul shots, and rebounds?
It's scoring, rebounds, and assists. So
okay.
if you have at least 10 of each of those, you've got a triple-double.
I think I should get some credit for that.
Later, but yes.
Okay.
But it is, it's a made-up statistic, honestly. So it's like you have to put those three together and say, here's something. He's the first one who did this X time. So it's okay. The fact
and all statistics are made up.
This one. The fact that the Times thought this was noteworthy of thinking about is that the best season ever is kind of comical. What's worse is that they decide that, in fact, it is, even after they're comparing it to all these other entries that they solicit from other contributors.
So what are the other entries?
Well, there are many. They're not worth talking about. There's only one worth talking about.
And yet we're bringing it up.
No, I'm going to talk about the one that is worth talking about. Wilt Chamberlain happens to be in the same sport as Westbrook, so it's an easy comparison. In 1961 and 1962, Wilt Chamberlain had a season that is kind of hard to believe. He averaged 50 points a game and 25 rebounds a game, which is unbelievable.
Okay.
He averaged that during the season.
Wait, 25 rebounds?
And 50
25
points.
Rebounds a game?
And he averaged
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nobody. He averaged that. No one in the NBA has done anything like this this season or any season that I can remember in recent
memory.
But
is it harder to do the 50 points or the 25 rebounds?
Depends who you are.
Okay.
But I would say they're both hard. They're equally hard.
Okay.
To do them both is just phenomenal. He averaged that for the season. I can go on and on for his stats in that season. He even had a game where he famously scored 100 points in a game. That was during that season. He had another game where he scored 78 points and had 43 rebounds. But here's the statistic that really gets me for that season for him. And that is that he played 3,882 minutes in an 80-game season. Now, a lot of you doing the math quickly are going to say, well, gee, the games are 48 minutes long, they're 80 games. So that they don't have that many minutes in the season. The truth is, they played some overtime games. So the fact of the matter is, he played more than the regulation amount of minutes in the season. He played every single minute of every game for 80 games except for 8, which is bizarre.
That does sound bizarre.
All right? Right now, the very best players are averaging, you know, at best 3/4 of the minutes, which means they're missing 12 minutes, 15 minutes every game. He played everything but 8. It's bizarre. For his career.
That sounds like a real...
Right. So, Will Chamberlain, I mean, two things about Will Chamberlain quickly. The one thing that younger listeners might say, younger being my son Granger, might say, but who did he play against? He was 7 feet tall, and there was no one else his size. Uh-huh. And the truth is, that's during those times, they had better centers than they have now. So, you were talking about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You're talking about Bob Lanier. You're talking about Willis Reed. You're talking about Walt Bellamy. You're talking about Bill Russell. You're talking about Zelmo Beatty.
So he was playing against.
He's playing against other 7-footers, or maybe someone 6'10".
Right.
That's number one. And number two is for his career, he averaged over 30 points and 20 rebounds a game. And what happens in any career, including his, is the last 2 years aren't so good.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you right now, I don't think anyone in the NBA this season had a single game where they had 30 points and 20 rebounds.
Is it all impressive that he's... to me, points sounds like offense and rebounds sounds like defense.
Largely,
is it unusual for a basketball player to be good at both?
It's not unusual, but it's unusual for the basketball player to be as good at it as Chamberlain was. Chamberlain was unique. There is this thought in all sports that people keep getting better and athletes are better. And the players... in the past couldn't compete with the players today. I think it's worth thinking about because it's logically, it's extremely possible that sometimes you reach the apex 20, 30 years before you were born, Granger. And and I think we had the apex in Wilt Chamberlain. We wanted to talk about two or three obituaries quickly. One is, I'll just comment on, a woman named Mary Anderson passed away. And what's interesting about her, other than the fact that she was 107, is that she was the co-founder of REI.
She apparently was dissatisfied with the climbing equipment that was available when she and her husband started climbing.
That's right. So she, instead of just...
they started making it.
Instead of sending away,
she
started REI. And, you know, she's laudable. She and her husband... First of all, it's a
co-op. We don't climb.
But there's still time.
We buy a lot of REI stuff.
We do buy a lot of REI stuff.
They sell cycling.
Well, they have a wonderful philosophy. They try to give back. They give back rebates. Cooperative.
She formed it as a co-op. Yeah.
She did, and she kept it as a co-op. Right now, they have 140 stores. The last year, the revenue is $2.56 billion, all because Mary couldn't get her hands on a good axe. So
hats off to Mary Anderson. And I just noticed, you know, being a teacher, teacher stories resonate or grab me. And Pat McKissick passed away. She was an English teacher who became a writer of biographies and novels, but biographies for sort of young adult and I would say elementary school children of predominantly Black African American notable characters, in addition to fables and stories and you know things like that. And that just resonated a little bit because I know you did this too, I think. When you're growing up, when you're in elementary school, you read like those orange biographies, simplistic biographies of American.
I don't think it was simplistic. I read them.
But you know, I mean, they were very...
Kit Carson.
They were inspiring. And and so you can see why she'd be drawn to, you know, create inspiring characters like that. But also, I like the story with her husband. Her husband was actually an engineer.
Oh, yeah, I remember you told me that.
And he had a construction business. It was struggling at a certain point. And they were sitting down having a talk about what to do. She was quite distressed about this. And he just said to her, well, if you could do anything right now, she at the time was a, you know, had was an editor and teacher. What would you do if you could do anything? She said, I'd write. And he said, okay, let's write. I'll help you. And he did a great deal of the research, and these were collaborative efforts more than anything. And later she actually collaborates with her son, graphic novels with the same kind of idea. Huh. So just kind of interesting. Pat McKissick.
All right. And the other one we wanted to mention was a fellow named Eugene Lang, who died at the age of 98. Eugene Lang was an industrialist who made a lot of money, but where he became well known was in 1981. Eugene Lang was giving the commencement address at a sixth grade graduation, and he said it occurred to him he was just going to be speaking a lot of platitudes that wouldn't really register. And he did feel strongly that they had this group had a chance of success. He wanted to help them, so he almost impulsively said to the group, I will pay for everyone's college education. This was in a disadvantaged area. And people were kind of stunned. They said, what are you saying? He says, I will pay. I have the money. I'll pay for everyone in this group's college education. And it got quite a bit of publicity. I even remember it to some degree. I don't know if you remember it, Tamsin. But there are...
I remember mentioning it.
There are a few copycat initiatives. And what's interesting about this is it's a very bold move. It sounds great. And it sounds like the kind of concrete, specific initiative that you need to sort of give disadvantaged folks an opportunity and really move the ball forward in terms of making education more accessible. And yet, it's a simple solution to a much more complicated problem. And what happens is that particular initiative didn't succeed particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was didn't shock a lot of people. Matter of fact, apparently someone pulled him aside as soon as he said it, who was with the school, said, look, that's nice, but only a couple of these kids are going to go to college, even if you pay for it. And what the obituary becomes about is that it wasn't clearly successful. You need a much more nuanced approach to that kind of issue. But to Eugene Lang's...
Need to even start before
grade. Yes, yeah. Eugene Lang's credit, he participated in that. So mm-hmm. they became less PR material, more on the way of
trying to find
grassroots problems.
Solutions.
As you said, Tamsin, one of the things he determined was sixth grade is too late to make that kind of offer. He got involved in various types of initiatives that just didn't make the front pages, and he tried his best to help these folks out. So even though his very bold initiative was just a little too simplistic, even though it was mm-hmm. very PR-oriented, mm-hmm. To his credit, he's the kind of guy who sort of stuck with it and tried to make a difference. You were going to talk about something with respect to food, I think.
Well, food. I always like to talk about food and read about food. And I was thinking about peas this week because, Easter. You often eat peas as part of the Easter dinner. When I was growing up, we had leg of lamb and peas and things like that.
We might have, too. I don't remember. It's
possible. Peas is a spring food, so it makes some sense. And sure enough, in the New York Times magazine section, my buddy, Gabrielle Hamilton, my girl crush, has a recipe for a pea recipe. And we were sitting around reading. Sadie found something that mentioned that peas, 3/4 cup of peas, has more protein than an egg.
Yeah, that's surprising.
That is surprising.
Only because you don't think peas have any protein.
And then, of course, I Googled peas and pea nutrition, etc. Peas will cure everything.
Right.
Everything. So
that's
there you
our
have.
Newest
so
thing
that
will cure everything.
And then the Wall Street Journal also mentioned sorghum, which is a syrup. Have you ever had sorghum?
No.
Sorghum is a syrup made from sorghum grass.
Yeah.
Originally comes from Africa. And my father, it was more popular in the South, I would say. My father went to school in the South, and he was a big sorghum fan. And so, it might be time to get back into sorghum.
Well,
apparently, sorghum cures everything, too.
Everything.
It's very loaded with iron.
The Ogden Nash, you see the Ogden Nash quote that he eats peas on a fork with honey?
Yes.
Because it helps him stay on the fork. So they don't taste very good, I think he said, but it helps him stay
on
the fork.
Was it on the fork or the knife?
The knife. I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. Peas on the knife.
Yeah. And then there's also a review of a book about Southern Korean food or Korean food in general by Graham Holiday, Eating Korea by Graham Holiday.
Uh-huh.
And Korean food is interesting, very interesting, almost a little challenging. It's a real nose to tail. kind of thing. Right. And he was lamenting the the loss of all these kind of obscure traditional recipes, such as skate fermented in its own urine.
I'm glad. I knew we weren't going to get into some skate.
This might be a little bit beyond me.
I know enough about the Korean food. There's some a little simpler.
But if you're interested in Korean food, it might be an interesting read. Okay. Graham Holiday.
You don't have to make everything in the book, Tamsin. Just use your discretion. The Times had a...
How do you even get the...
What?
The skates to urinate.
Are we still talking about this?
You know, it boggles the mind.
Let's discuss it later.
All right, move on.
You threw me off. It's not the Times. The Wall Street Journal had a review of a book, which I've seen in various publications, which is Hemingway Didn't Say This. And it's a book about quotations that were not really made by the folks to whom they're normally attributed. And it turns out, if you read this book, that some of the most well-known quotations are wrongly attributed.
Right. There's one, the Yogi Berra one, that everybody...
No one goes to that restaurant because it's too crowded type thing.
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, but they're... Right, so... But what's nice about these, and you just go through them quickly, they're fun quotations anyway. I mean, they're fun to know about. It doesn't make any difference who said them. It just adds a little twist. So there's the quote, "May you live in interesting times," which is an ancient Chinese proverb, and it turns out it goes back to 1944. So
it's not ancient to some people. Ancient to our kids, but not, perhaps not Chinese.
Ancient to some kids. Writing about music is like dancing about architecture. That was Elvis Costello, strangely enough, but maybe not. Turns out not really Elvis Costello. But now we get into more profound quotes. "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing." Edmund Burke. Well, turns out it's not Edmund Burke. It's not clear. It's a tribute to others, but Edmund Burke didn't quite say that, which is too bad. Here's a good one. "Behind every good fortune, there is a crime." Balzac. But not quite. Turns out it's not Balzac. "Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration." Edison, in fact, he did say it.
But I understand sometimes he said it was 2%.
Close enough for me.
Right. And my favorite.
Well, I'll get to your favorite. An eye for an eye will make the whole world blind. Gandhi? No. Here's your favorite. I know you well enough to know what your favorite is. "You can get much further with a kind word and a gun than with a kind word alone."
That's not true. I'm interested in the next one.
Number one, it is true.
It is true, but it's not my favorite.
But it's not Al Capone.
Not a kind of...
And finally, what apparently is your favorite, "If your only tool is a hammer, then
everything
every problem looks like a nail."
Yes.
Mark Twain? No.
I think you said that to me recently.
Did I say that?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like me.
No, it doesn't, but I think...
It wasn't me. Because to me, every problem does look, like a nail. So, in any event, it's an interesting book.
Let me just say, is that about it? We're winding down?
Yes, I was going to
wind down. Okay, I should just warn everybody.
Yeah.
All right, because it's been kind of a busy, crazy time. There is the chance that we take a slight hiatus.
Well, only
and
one week.
We usually post on Wednesday, Tuesday night or Wednesday. We may miss a week.
We'll
give everybody a chance to catch up on...
the other movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we'll see. Keep tuned in. Keep posted. We'll see. In any event, let's just close with a quote that I can attribute to the right person, and it's kind of a nice quote on Easter. And it is this fellow, Eugene Lang, who followed through with his philanthropy, notwithstanding that his bold gesture didn't really succeed. "Giving should not be mechanical," he said. "It should be the fruit of one's feeling, love, and sense of responsibility. Giving is not giving back. There's no quid pro quo. Giving is self-fulfillment." Well, there's a thought.
Nice.
And that's all we have this week from Tamsin and Dan Read the Papers. See you possibly next week or the week after.